Nathan Buckley is with me in the studio. Hello, Bucks.
G'day, Jared. How are you?
I'm well. What did you think?
Well, that's the toughest position you're ever going to find yourself in a football existence. Because players are designed to play and you prepare under the rock. We don't see that. And then whatever pops out on the surface, which is the weekend, is what you're judged on. But Dyson rocked up there and had to defend the indefensible for himself, for his teammates, for his leadership group, for himself, for his leadership group, for his teammates, for his club, his coach, the list manager, the CEO and the board. So that's a really, that's as tough as you're going to get it. And we did see passion from him, but he's quite an understated type guy. Like he seems like a laconic, relaxed guy, and he's copped criticism for that. But I love the fact that he was unapologetic for that's who I am, but he was defending the indefensible. The actions aren't backing up those words, and he knew it, and he feels that every time he throws out those lines, he knows that they're just window dressing at the moment. But he's going to be one of them that needs to roll their sleeves up and show something, do something.
Is there anything that he can say that, like, are there cues that you would look for? Is the understanding of the scenario, the acceptance of it, the challenge within it, the pledge of unity, the vow that the work is being done? Is there anything in there that triggers with you? At least that's recognition.
I don't think so, because no, there wasn't, and I reckon it's nearly impossible to have it, because when you've heard it before from like Andy McGrath about a month ago, I think, and the question there, I thought the questions asked were the right ones. You know, we're asking about, you know, does it mean enough to you, and like that's an easy question to ask when you're not winning, but. It's a very stressful environment that they're in at the moment, and we look at under effort or a less than capacity to pressure or intensity, and everyone thinks that means that they're not trying. What I find generally is that's a symptom of having played the game before you get out there. It's a symptom of overthinking. It becomes a cerebral process, and all of your training, all of your preparation is to make it a thoughtless, instinctive reaction that everyone knows is going to happen because it's part of the synergy of a team unit. Essendon are the opposite end of the spectrum of that at the moment. And it's actually, it'd be really hard for him to say there, look, we went in with that intent and we were really trying to get that done, but then obviously their method was poor and they just weren't able to pressure, and then they would have got 15. Well, at 15 minutes in the first quarter, it looked like they were roughly up and about, but then there was a couple of situations through the middle of the field where there was just no pressure and you thought, wow, that just flicked. So they can have 10 good minutes, but they're going to get in the game and find reasons why they're going to keep going. So it's very difficult for Heppel for anyone who's speaking for Essendon at the moment to appease the judgment and criticism and harsh glare that is coming their way, because the only thing that's going to do that is a response on the field. And we're not seeing that a basis of any of that at the moment.
The touchstone moment has become the Parker taunting of Scheel.
Yeah.
I think part of it, A, is it the right touchstone? And B, should that moment have been, should Heppel have been more cognizant of that? Now, they're not gathering till today, so whatever they're going to do collectively with that hasn't been done yet. Did that surprise you at all?
So he hadn't seen it,
yeah,
and obviously hadn't been at the club, so it wasn't addressed. But it's been heavily through the media. That doesn't mean that he needs to absorb it. One of the difficult things when you get in a scenario like this, and I've been here as a player, I've been here as a leader, I've been here as a coach. It's tough, and if you've had a long enough time in the game, very, very few haven't been in this situation. And 2-7 isn't as dire as some situations that we've seen teams in, but it's the current one. Yeah, and we think like West Coast and North been done to death, and now Essendon's there, and they're the three that are really struggling and languishing. But so I've been here, and it's a really difficult situation to be in. It's a really tough place, but it's not fatal. They really do need to own it. The challenge with this, so Dyson says he's playing off a halfback flank, so he's not around where this happened at centre bounce, and you're not going to see everything on a football field. Cameras are everywhere, and you're not always going to pick that up. But there's nothing to say that Dyson Heppel or any other Essendon person needs to be answering the questions that the media throw at them. They need to answer the questions that they ask themselves for themselves, because otherwise you get dragged left, right and centre by agendas that are outside of your organisation, and their assertions and characterisations of people who don't have all the information inside a football club, which is why the bunkering down that he mentioned a lot, that's valid and you need to do that. I don't think I would get all the players to switch Twitter off. I would try and remove as much of the external message and noise as you can, and but you've got to replace that with something. So there's got to be something that the coach or the leaders bring into the environment that becomes the basis of whatever we're going to build from in this next little period. But removing the external noise is bloody difficult, because there's a lot of it. There's more glare in today's footy than there ever has been.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if there's, we talk about an overlap game on a Friday or games that overlap for 15 minutes. We used to have seven games on a Saturday afternoon and you wouldn't see them all. So legend became how things were transferred. We didn't see every bit of vision and every bit of tribunal and every mistake that players make. We never analysed it like this before.
Is there, so in the bunkering down period, is there a worth in understanding how you are perceived from the outside without living every agenda and comment that you've spoken of? Or so can you get too insular in your bunker down phase?
I would suggest, my gut would be that you are more likely, say a month ago, so what would have been at one and four, narrow loss or narrow win against Adelaide, and then lose to Fremantle in round five. So 1-4. I would suggest that, say, the opinion from outside did sneak in then. I would say it's more detrimental than it is beneficial. So I think you actually get into this situation by listening too much to the outside. And I think the better organisations and the better teams have a way of waterproofing that when they're going through these tough periods, and they make actions now to turn it around now, because if you let it go for a week or two or three, then it becomes you, and then you know what the opinion is because you've already let it in, but then you're trying to shut it out. It's they're in a world of pain, but we're talking like this is dire. Like this is a first world problem. Like this is a game. We're talking about a game of footy with a club. And I know that the Essendon supporters would be passionate about it. And there's a bit of car crash mentality and, what's happening on the side of the road, like driving past Essendon, and that looks bad. But like this is not going, it's not going to last. So Dyson's words in that regard were really strong. It's not going to last. But we just put so much focus on things that aren't working on a piece of green grass in the middle of the city, because we have our emotions tied to the results of our so heavily to our team.
Was that a perspective that you got along the way? You would have at times lived it was the most important thing in the world, wouldn't you?
That was hard earned.
I would think so.
It wasn't just a piece of green grass. It was sacred. It was everything that I ever wanted. I think you, like I still have a love and a passion for the game, and it still is important to me. But it used to be the be all and end all, and you sort of have to wonder. We've seen a lot of players come through that it's not the be-all and end-all, but they've been champions of the game. Like Max Gawn's probably one guy that's going about it slightly differently. The way Dyson Heppel carries himself is different. See, I digress with Dyson. I fear that he's not physically capable of doing what needs to be done as a leader at Essendon at the moment with that real physical element, but that's another thing for him. We're seeing players that go about it a different way. And, oh, geez, I had to learn the hard way because I would have blown – I think you generally blow yourself up. And we see a lot of players come out the other side that haven't been able to make that perspective, and then all of a sudden playing the game is taking away from them, and it really does have an effect on your psyche and your welfare. And we've also got to consider that. What Dyson did last night was as difficult as that he's ever going to have to do in his professional career. It's harder than the hardest game of footy you've ever played. On the individual and the criticism that comes his way. So I see that, and I see the person, I see the human that's sitting in that chair that drops a few F-bombs, that's really trying to defend the indefensible, understanding that his words are cheap, but he still needs to front up and he still needs to do it. And I have real empathy for the human underneath that Essendon facade that is trying to speak on behalf of his team.
We've got those who want to share how it's landed with them. So my last one on that is should it have been the coach rather than the captain?
Potentially, but then it's always the coach. Maybe it should be the CEO. Maybe it should be the list manager. But that's the thing. We don't know how and why they're having a season that they've had. So if we're in the NFL now, we were speaking about this off air, they're far more ruthless and cutthroat in other sports. The AFL is probably the most accepting of rebuilds of development phases, because in the NFL, if you don't win for 3 or 4 weeks and you've underachieved in expectations, bang, you're out. So a coach gets the bullet over there, going through maybe 2 weeks of distress. Coaches get the bullet here; they get dragged through the coals for 2 or 3 years because, on the guise of development, and we'll get there and rebuild and. Yeah, you know, and potentially because the decision makers in the clubs aren't as ruthless, potentially, on the basis of a longer term strategy, then when we don't have success that you expect, well then the fans kick up and they become the restless, ruthless response, not the decision makers. So maybe we could have heard from someone else, but I think Dyson was fair. It was his 200th game. He's a strong leader in the football club, or a senior leader in the football club. So he was in the right place to speak on their behalf.
How did it land with you? Justin's in Ferntree Gully. Welcome, Justin.
Gentlemen, good morning. My conclusion from last night is that, you know, Dyson Heppel was on a hiding to nothing. And, you know, overall, I'm just really disappointed in the club for putting him up, because it just felt like, yet again, the toothless Essendon Football Club hung their captain out to dry. The president talked a big game in the pre-season, and basically him and the CEO have been silent ever since. And, Bucks, I'll ask you, would Eddie have allowed Scott Pendlebury to bare his soul in public like that?
Would Eddie have allowed it? Eddie wouldn't make those decisions, first and foremost. The general workings of the club is under the guise of the CEO, who's employed by the board. And then the way I would think a club should operate, and that's obviously great observations, Justin, and I agree he was on a hiding to nothing. I think when there's good news, you wheel out the president. When there's bad news, you wheel out the CEO on the business side of the structure. When there's good news or things are going well, I think you get, I don't know whether this is just from self-preservation, but you let the senior coach deliver that stuff. When there's question marks about, when there's sort of hard, I think that's when the football manager's role comes into vogue. So the football manager should be speaking, should have a more prevalent public image for the media than they actually do. I think that because they're key decision makers in the whole football program, and ultimately they've got touch points in more of the football program than the senior coach does. Conditioning, medical, list management, recruiting. So that it all goes in, and coaching is another arm. So you've got all those four major arms and then coaching. So welfare. I think the football managers are the ones that need to be visible and stand up in this particular situation.
Yep. Adrian's in Roval. Welcome, Adrian.
How are you, boys?
Very well.
Nathan, just thank you for bringing me a little bit of balance, because I was on breathing fire. I really wasn't actually impressed with Dyson's effort last night. And not that he could have done a great deal, but there was a stage after the footage was shown, and Luke Parker, let's be real, classful fact, which is surprising because I've always rated him as a footballer. But there was a segment there, and after it showed the vision, it cut back to Dyson, and he actually looked angry. And I was thinking, I'm finally going to hear what an Essendon supporter I want to hear. And then he went back to the media training and put up the walls and spoke club speak, which was disappointing because even though Dyson is not the, and you touched on it yourself, you as a leader, Nathan, I don't think you would have ever allowed that. Maybe you mightn't have seen it, but you would have been strong in the media. You always were. Dyson is not a physical leader. He's definitely a great mouthpiece for the football club, 100%. And an Essendon supporter is a kid, so he gets the culture. But as an Essendon supporter, we don't want to see the niceties because that's how we're deemed right now. We're deemed as a nice football club. We're deemed as a football club that doesn't have an edge. And premiership-winning football clubs aren't football clubs that don't have an edge. They don't play social football. They don't play nice football. And there was that moment where Dyson looked like he was red hot and he was ready to go. And he just backed off. And I understand the club wants sanitised, clean messaging out there. The fans are the backbone of any football club. We're the paying members. We're the ones who put bums on seats and put salaries in pockets. We want to see our captain emotional. It's the Josh Marnies of the world and the Ben Ruttons of the world that we want to see the sanitised, thought-out messaging from. We want to see a captain lead from the front. And one of his men needed him to have his back last night, and he just didn't. He backed away, and he was clean, and he was sanitised. And as a fan base, we wanted more than that from him last night. I wanted more from him last night than that when he saw that vision, if he did see it for the first time. And to be honest, really disappointed in the media department that he went out there completely unprepared for what he was about to see if he really hadn't seen that footage, because I don't know if he goes and hides under a rock after a game. It's been everywhere.
Yeah, I can hear the emotion in your voice, Adrian, and there's a time and a place for the Essendon players and coaches to show emotion. And it's around their performance. It's in their performance and what they put out in the weekend. I think you'd much prefer to see actions there than you would him, you know, as you said, getting angry on a chair in a studio on a Monday night. So he wasn't hiding to nothing because he was. I don't think he was ever going to be able to appease you and a lot of the Essendon supporters because they, you know, short of taking his shirt off and getting the cat of nine tails out and whipping himself and seeing him bleed from the back. I mean, that's what you want to see, the people that aren't living up to your expectations. You want to see him hurt. This has got to be something. But he's hurting, and you could see that. You could feel that. But he's been – like, sometimes we put people in positions and they're not capable, like, out of role. Like, it's not part of their traits. Now, Dyson is not a hard-edged leader. I don't see him as a hard-edged leader. So to put him in a role and then to expect him to become a hard-edged leader, he doesn't have those traits in the way that he plays the game. He doesn't have those traits as a person in his personality. He has got perspective. He's the perspective guy. He's the guy that puts things in balance. You have gratitude, and he's been a very good footballer over a period of time, but he's not your run someone down from behind and inspire the troops with a physical act. That's not the way. He can go back with a flight. He can do anything, but you've got to be in that situation first. But you can't expect people to not be themselves and to be performing, because if you're performing, you're even more lost than you are elsewhere.
Adrian, thank you. Reg is in Ringwood. Welcome, Reg.
Hey, thanks, guys. Long-time Essendon member. I'm just devastated. I wasn't convinced by Heppel last night. And I'll tell you why. We were promised blue-collar football, right? If you want to be a blue-collar team, you've got to be the fittest, best-tackling, high-pressure, contested possession team. We're a club that doesn't value contested possession. And this whole mantra, oh, we've got a brand that's going to be blue-collar. Well, where's the tackling? Where's the effort? Where's the fitness? We've got more soft tissue injuries than anyone else. We can't tackle. We can't man up. And we just don't put any value on contested possession. And look at our recruiting. Our recruiting will tell you that. So I look back at the club and say, where's the chairman? Where's the CEO? And where on earth is this blue-collar football? I mean, come on. They're playing the opposite of blue-collar football.
And you can't argue with that at all, Reg. The number from the weekend that stood out to me wasn't 30, which was the effective tackles. The big number was 52. 52 tackle attempts in a whole game of football. That's that's bizarre. You know, so what are you looking at? 13 and a half tackle efforts a quarter. Tackle efforts a quarter. And you lay seven. That's unfathomable. On a postage stamp oval like the SCG, you don't have to do as much running as you might need to go and get those, to get into the little circle, to have tackle efforts. You didn't win contested ball. They only lost by 12, but they didn't win contested ball. You've got plenty of opportunities to tackle, to chase, to pressure. 39 physical acts. So 39 physical acts where even if it wasn't classed as an effective tackle, it was a body-on-body clash. 39 is less than half of the average in the comp. So it was a really poor performance, and the review today will not be pretty. And the tack that the coaches take is going to be important. Less is more in these circumstances, because you can sit in a room for 90 minutes and look at all the edits. It's just reminding you how you haven't achieved what you said you're going to do. But you only need to see two or three, and then you need to take ownership and move forward.
We work our way through our McCafe menu today. Nathan Buckley got us underway. It's there on the podcast. Andrew Voss across the Great Divider. A lot of you have had your say around Essendon and broader footy topics as well. A little bit of A-League later in this hour with the semi-final series, which feature three Melbourne teams in the last four, and yet just a distinct lack of, well, what would you say, vibe around those matches. So we'll explore that shortly on our McCafe menu, our official coffee partner. But from time to time, the godfather of sports administration in this country, Malcolm Speed, comes into the studio and we kick around the relevant topic. Since last we spoke, Gillon McLachlan has resigned as the chief executive of the AFL, and that transition process, which will run the course of the year, has begun. Tasmania has thrust itself very much forward for the AFL licence. The NBL has given a fascinating case study on what that might look like, and Malcolm's got a bit of hands-on experience in that front as well. Malcolm, it's great to see you as ever. Welcome back.
Yes, thanks, Jared. Good to be here.
What did you think when Gil McLachlan announced his time was coming?
I thought he'd gone a bit early. I thought there was a bit more in the tank there, but he has been a terrific chief executive for the AFL. And what I like about Gillon's time there is he's actually been there for 20 years. He learnt the trade. He learnt the art of being a chief executive from other chief executives. He went through a number of different roles there in strategy and broadcast, and was chief operating officer there for a while when Andrew Demetrio was chief executive. So he was well and truly ready for the job, despite the fact that very well trained for it, an outstanding individual. I thought he was great. I thought his time there has been a time of great progress for the AFL, and Gil was the right man for the job.
Was he the exact right man for the circumstances that presented of the pandemic?
Yes, he was. He's measured. He's calm. He took a long-term view. He's not terribly hard to fluster. He's very balanced, and he took a long-term view and got the game through a very difficult time there. So that was a very testing time for him. There have been some other issues along the way, and that's always going to be the case. It's a job, I think, if we think about jobs in Victoria, we've got the Premier and we've got the Leader of the Opposition. I think the Chief Executive of the AFL sits somewhere between those two roles in terms of importance in jobs to Victorians. So it's a big job.
Is it the number one sports administrative job in the country?
Yes, I think it is. I always thought the cricket job, which I had, was the best job, but the biggest job is the AFL chief executive. That's the one that's you're on the front page, you're on the back page, you're on the TV news, you're on AFL 360 with you and Robbo, and you're on the radio, and it really is a big job, and it's important to everyone in Victoria. Not everyone. There are some young babies who haven't yet formed a view about the AFL and the AFL's chief executive, but everyone has a view about the AFL and how it's managed.
Does the public face of it share a lot in common with the Premier and the Prime Minister, do you think?
Yes, I think so, although Gil has a particular style, doesn't he? I can't see him ever going into politics, but he'd be good at it if he did.
Yeah, how so? Why do you think that? Why does he strike you as that?
I think just his balance, his calm, He's strategic. He has a long-term view. He has great experience. He hasn't come up through a political prism. He's been out there in the forefront of an important part of Australian life for 20 years. So anyway, let's not create a headline. Gill's going into politics. I could not imagine him doing it.
The interesting aspect to it, so the long goodbye in sport, is relatively rare, I think. He's going to do all the central business of the AFL before he leaves. So his successor is going to inherit almost all of the key deals. How does that strike you?
Particularly for the broadcast deal, I think that's great. it's a very hard job running a major sport like the AFL. So hundreds of millions of dollars. The broadcast deal is the key plank of that. Now, when you negotiate a broadcast deal, you don't just sit down with the broadcaster and say, okay, $2 billion or we're walking away, and the broadcaster says, oh, no, 1.5, and you split the difference. It's a long process. The broadcast deal these days has many parts, and it's a difficult concept. So you'd have the free-to-air deal, the pay deal, there'll be a streaming deal, radio rights have to be out there. The AFL will want to reserve some parts of the broadcast for its own outlets. There are all sorts of complications. Some of the easy things are the anti-siphoning legislation. There are things like geo-blocking where you have to... do you sell worldwide? Do you sell it all at once? Do you break it up into component parts? So what that involves, every one of those sorts of deals I'm talking about is a 200-page agreement, and you need to get your head around it. Now, Gill's done that. I was involved in some broadcast deals. They're very messy. I negotiated some with Indian broadcasters, and your main objective is you can only sell it once, so you can't overlap. There can't be overlap between package A and package B and package C, and you don't want to get sued down the track. And you don't want the broadcaster to be able to walk away if the ratings don't work. So it's massively complicated, and Gill is the expert. Now, if one of the guys who've been mentioned at the AFL as possible successors, if they were to work through that process with Gill, they then need to deliver the next deal. Now, that's the second hard part of it. You negotiate the deal, and then within the structure of the AFL, they need to deliver that, keep the public happy with what they've sold, deliver it to a high level, keep the broadcasters happy, keep the government happy. It's a great learning experience to have sat in on it. So for Gill to do it, yes, I'm all for that. Do as many of those important deals as you can. The incoming chief executive will get a chance to do that next time round. They come round reasonably quickly, these things, whether it's broadcast or sponsorship. But to have the expert do this one and underpin the game, there's plenty to do in that role without having to do a broadcast agreement as soon as you land. And not many people are capable of doing them.
What we read from the outside, so the trip to America, Paramount is clearly going to be... at the very least, a good bargaining chip for the AFL is what streaming looks like, in with what we've come to learn around free-to-air TV and around subscription. What's your early read of the landscape that they would be working with?
In terms of dollars or?
Probably competition, maybe.
Jared, it'll be complicated. There will be interest from the free-to-air broadcasters. There'll be interest from different pay broadcasters, and maybe some outlets that we haven't seen before. And then this streaming is a whole new dimension to it. I haven't quite got my head around what that's going to look like for AFL, but it's something we'll watch with interest, and it needs experts working on it.
What does the AFL need in a successor to Gill McLachlan?
It's a good question, Jared. It needs... someone with a background in sport. It would be very difficult to come into this role and not have worked in sport previously. Someone who can handle the pressure. It's a high-pressure job. There'll be all sorts of crises that will emerge, and the chief executive will be expected to deal with those, and will have to deal with them and deal with them effectively. And everything that he or she says will be scrutinised by the media. Every word will be scrutinised, and by the public. It's very difficult. The personal life of the chief executive comes into play, and we've seen that a number of times. It's mighty difficult. So great judgment, some vision, a strategic outlook, thick skin, sense of humour, all those sorts of things. They're needed there, Gerard. But it's increasingly a multifaceted job. It's commercial in the first sense. It's sport-based, so perhaps it's more value-driven than dollar-driven. There needs to be that balance between the values of the sport and the dollars of the sport. And it's a public-facing role as much as anything, so a very good communicator. And that's been Gil's strength, to see him on with you and Robbo, as I said, that just to see a softer side of him, a different side of him, answering difficult questions with you can't duck and dodge there. You have to answer them. So, yes, a difficult role.
The command of the job, I think, is really interesting. So then there's been able to do it, and then there's been the public authority. So I think it's a really interesting time. Is the NRL has Peter Volandis. Now, he's not the chief executive, and we've spoken about that before. Publicly commanding figure. Does Gill's replacement need to be in that way, able to match what the rival code has?
That will be one criterion on which the role is judged. I'm not so sure that's the major factor there. I think it's just it needs someone who can be a public spokesperson for the game. To manage that role effectively. I think what we'll also see is there will be a new chief executive with the training wheels on, and there's always a learning curve. If someone were to come in from outside, and I did that with cricket, I came in from outside, from basketball to cricket. It took me 6 months to understand what was going on and who was who and who could be trusted and who couldn't. So that's difficult. I think we'll see Richard Goyder, the chair of the AFL, I think he'll step up and be much more public. And Richard, with Gillen there, has not needed to have a very public face. But I think we'll see more of Richard in the first year, the first 2 years or so, as the chief executive works into the role.
So you were on the Richmond board and saw Brendan Gale's work at Richmond. Do you think he should be a candidate?
I don't know whether he wishes to be a candidate, and that's that's something I'm not going to presume that Brendan will be in there. I think Brendan has all the characteristics. He's a natural leader. He's strategic. He has great vision. He's experienced. He's been at Richmond now, 13, 14 years. Before that, he was with the AFL Players Association. He practiced as a lawyer for a little while. He's very skillful. He's managed a relatively large organisation and a large budget, and he's been very, very successful. So, yes, he's one of the few people, I think, in football, in sport, who could do this job. I'd like to see him do it, although as an avid Richmond supporter, I'd also like Brendan to spend the next 40 years at Richmond winning premierships.
Do you know whether there were tensions between the AFL and Richmond during those successful years that would be an inhibitor to him being the chief executive?
Gerard, I don't know of any. I've read some snippets about that, but I certainly don't know of any. And if there were, it's not all that unusual that successful clubs clash with head office all the time. If Richmond had those issues, Collingwood would have had them. The other successful teams, all of the teams, in fact, some of the unsuccessful teams would have had them because they would have been arguing over money.
And the tension piece around the internal candidate or the external candidate. Now, Brendan is not terribly external, but he's not in at head office where they have three candidates. And I think Travis Ould is seen as the one internally. Should the commission, how seriously should you consider how the dynamic changes if you bring in the external rather than a smooth transition within an executive team?
Well, that'd be something the commission would look at, but I think they'd also want to know that the incoming external candidate, as you term it, had a track record of being able to work well with key people. And this is one of the things Gil did well and Brendan does well. He gets the best out of his people. Richmond's success there with that Brendan strategy and the 100,000 members and the premierships, that was Brendan leading his management team, including the coach, and he's very good at that. Gil was brilliant at that, at getting those people to respond and to work to a high level.